Hi, and welcome to Seeking What They Sought. I'm one of your hosts, Eric Edstrom. In this episode, we sit down for a conversation with Caleb Isley, the man behind Humans of Aventism. Caleb shares with us some of the lessons that he's learned while personally interviewing well over 500 Seventh-day Adventists. It's a conversation that you definitely don't want to miss. So get comfortable, and welcome back.
And now a word from our sponsors for this episode. Has the pandemic of COVID-19 affected your social life, maybe your love life? Do you miss those times in line meeting a new friend at the church potluck? Well, the Love Potluck has got you covered. The Love Potluck is a speed dating platform for Adventist singles. The people of the Love Potluck are passionate about creating a space for singles to make connections, especially during these distant times. So no matter where you are in the world, sign up for the Love Potluck today to have an opportunity to build a meaningful relationship with another person. You can find their website in the show notes of this episode. We want to thank the Love Potluck for sponsoring this episode of Seeking What They Sought. And with that said, let's dive right back into the episode.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Seeking What They Sought. We have a guest today. He is the founder and lead content creator, from what I hear, of Humans of Adventism. You may have heard of Humans of New York. Humans of Adventism is something that Caleb has been working on for the last few years. We'll let him introduce that more. But yeah, we're here today with Caleb. Caleb, your last name is pronounced, is it Isley?
It is Isley. Wow, nice.
Okay. Yes.
Just to be fair, I had to tell that. Jesse, I made sure that you did it right.
Sean was the one who actually checked on that.
I'm pretty sure before that he was going to say Isley. Is that how you were going to say it, Jesse?
Sure.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you've heard, Caleb?
Oh, Isil is pretty common. Isil, all variations that are wrong.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, so we're here today to talk a little bit about Humans of Adventism and the importance of learning people's stories. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about you. We were kind of getting to know you a little bit before this, but you kind of an interesting track compared to, I think, all of us who, you know, we went through Adventist school, then went to Adventist college and gotten an Adventist, you know, professional career. You have a different track than that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'll try not to take too much time. My life is very much one that has a lot of layers to it and a lot of twists and turns to it. So it's always difficult for me to kind of like jam that down into a concise 5-minute description. I've lived in several states. When I was born, we lived in Mississippi. Moved from there to the Midwest, grew up in Indiana from first grade through 12th. Spent a couple of years in Ohio for college, dropped out, got married, moved to South Carolina for 7 years with my wife, and had the opportunity to move here to Oregon almost 2 years ago. A little background, socioeconomic factors played really strongly into my early life. One of the first years we lived in Mississippi, my dad told me, collectively, he and my mom made $12,500 for the year. Lived in a little trailer house there. A very different childhood than anybody else that I know. Not just because of poverty, also because of early divorce in my family. Raised Adventist, both of my parents divorced and remarried within a year to people who had never met a Seventh-day Adventist. So I go from, you know, vegetarian life, cooking bread at home, learning stuff from my mom to all of a sudden we've got hamburgers and all kinds of different things that was just a culture shock for me at home. I was also between homes in the summer and school year. I would stay with my dad for part of that and my mom for part of that. And also just I was raised in a very blue collar life. My dad started a masonry business when I was probably 7 years old, and my existence became work. If I was not in classes, my every moment, unless I was given specifically some free time, was working. And it didn't matter if I was, you know, helping do the dishes or clean the house, mow the yard, or actually going out onto a job site carrying brick for my dad at 9, 10 years old. My life truly was about work and school and nothing else. So church and Adventism and the things that come with that, pathfinders and these things, were kind of my outlet. They were my escape from work and school. Maybe school was tied in with that in an Adventist school, but literally until I was 18 years old, I did not have the experience of just going to my room and playing, like doing stuff like that. I remember when I moved out, actually, the first time I came home from my job and there was literally nothing I had to do. Like, I just got home and I was like, I've got 6 hours before I'm going to go to bed and I can do whatever I want with this time. And it was novel to me. So my life has actually been like this backward funnel. People talk about missing childhood and the freedom of that. I never do. Like, not one single moment of my life. It's always become easier as life went on. I actually feel like I have less responsibility now than I did at 12 years old. So it's an interesting approach. I was also, you know, raised my whole life in the Adventist church in a very, not a diverse area, very white, very conservative, very Ellen White on par with the Bible kind of thing. And so I really didn't have a lot of exposure. I did not have a black classmate until high school. I did not meet a gay person until high school and really get to know someone until college. Didn't have any extended conversations with Muslim people. And on top of that, I was in a very patriarchal approach, highly conservative politically, highly conservative religiously. I had never met a female pastor in my life. I really had almost never met a pastor that was under 50 years old in my life. So very particular yep. kind of upbringing. After getting married at 20 years old to my wife, she was 18, ended up just kind of, once we'd moved to a new state, leaving church. I felt that church was getting in the way of my relationship with God, and was not really doing a lot for community. And after leaving church, got really heavily involved with journalism, and we can get into that later, but kind of brought that journalistic background, that community oriented background that I learned outside of church back with me. So that's in a nutshell life up till now as best I can. All of those have their own very long, extended, complicated stories.
For sure. That's incredible. The Deep South is not some place I've spent a lot of time. My mom was in Georgia for a bit and I did not like that area. So that's my only experience, but I can imagine that for you, then growing up kind of in that space where you're kind of in a monolith, kind of in a silo, you have one perspective primarily, and then you kind of, all of it, you just kind of get brought into contact with people who are a little bit different. Does that have anything to do with why you decided to get into doing something like Humans of Adventism?
It has everything to do with it. What you're watching is not somebody who's good at something doing that thing. You're watching the discovery process. You're watching the self-education of a person who did not get exposed to other people. Every story is an intentional attempt to learn. And that's been the case the entire time. And what's driving that is really, I feel that I had a heart conversion through Humans of New York. Not Humans of New York alone, but I saw something in those stories. I started following those while I was in college during the time that I was kind of outside of church. I started seeing these stories of people that I wouldn't interact with normally. Stories of homeless people, stories of people from a different cultural background than me. And I started tracing my reactions between seeing the story and just seeing the picture, where I would think, oh, that person looks weird, or, oh, that person looks dangerous, or, oh, that's not a person that I would really want to get to know. But after taking the time to read just a few short paragraphs of their perspective, I noticed that they actually visually changed in my mind. Wow. Suddenly,
ooh, say more about that.
Yeah. Suddenly
I
was tracking kind of the repulsion factor, and I wouldn't have called it repulsion at the time. Obviously I would have just said, oh, like, I'm not really interested. And yet I was tracking and charting out in my own brain, people that I was kind of, I don't know, there was something there that was different than when I saw someone who looked like me. I don't know how to describe it. And it worked with age. It worked with socioeconomic status. It worked with race. It worked with religious background. It even worked with like what clothes they chose to wear. Humans of New York has pictures of people with the craziest outfits, right? Somebody who looks like they went to Party City, for sure. And dress themselves there, right? And what's what's the initial reaction to a picture like that? Like, what in the world are they doing, right? And yet, when you read their story, they seem a little more sane. They seem a little more like, you may still disagree with their fashion choice, right? But at the same time, once you've seen the world through their eyes, it makes a little more sense. Where you're like, okay, like I would sit down and talk to this person, like. It's fine. So I started tracking this reaction. And what was crazy was, after several months of consistently taking in stories, I started seeing it play out in my real life. There were classmates that I had and people in my community that initially, whether it was fear and ignorance or just a lack of knowledge on what our common ground would be, there was a tension where I actually would not initiate conversation. I would not try to actively pursue conversation with people. But through this experience, I started doing that. I started saying, oh, I don't have to know anything. I don't have to know to think like they have something of value. They have something to teach me. They're experiencing a world as full as mine, with all kinds of factors I've never thought about. And so there was this shift in my personality where, you know, growing up Adventist, and especially very conservative Adventist, you're taught an argumentative look at the world. You're taught a facts-based, argumentation-based, debate-based kind of approach. Well, when you play that out, like, there's all kinds of racism, sexism, homophobia that gets mixed in with that religious approach that you start spiritualizing your prejudice.
Good. A second. That's a statement right there. Spiritualizing your prejudice. Can you say more about that? Because that hits hard.
Sure. I mean, something as simple as we don't make noise in the sanctuary. Okay. Somebody who's raised in a white conservative church, they're going to think, oh, this is just a spiritual matter, right? This is just a spiritual matter. No, it's not. It's racist. Okay. Why? Because there are entire cultures of people who celebration is an aspect of worship, right? Powerful call and response with the preacher is an aspect of worship, and it's holy. You know, this is a way they're connecting with God, but when you've only experienced your kind of environment and you think that your environment is somehow closer to what God wants, there's a superiority, a mental superiority attitude that comes from that. And it really takes exposing yourself to other types of worship, other communities, and seeing what drives them, what they're connecting with, to really even begin to understand that, oh, how I saw things not just wasn't complete, but it's actually villainizing like a massive swath of the world. You are actually comparing your opinions and your preferences with the will of God. And to me, that's heretical. That's demonic. You know, it's not.
Well,
from God.
I agree with you, Caleb, except that everything that I think is exactly what God thinks. So that's where I disagree with you. So
Caleb, in the documentary, I remember in the trailer, you had said, when you were younger, you realized you hated Muslims.
I was afraid.
And okay. You were afraid. Sorry. Yeah. You were afraid of Muslims. And that's a very
big... tell everybody he hates Muslims right now. Is that what you're going to do?
Headline for the episode, Caleb hates Muslims. No, that you, when you were growing up, you were afraid of Muslims. And I wonder if, because I remember experiencing a similar thing. And I think for anyone who's grown up in a more insular community, mm-hmm. you're, as you're saying, you're sort of taught to view the other, you're taught to view anyone different than you as other, as scary. And I'm wondering, I guess, is that what you're talking about? This kind of argumentative approach to, I guess I'm curious more on your thoughts on that. Where does that come from and how do we do better, I guess?
Yeah, so this comes from a really strong aspect of Adventism back in my grandparents' great-grandparents' time. A central element of their preaching was this idea of creeping compromise. There was actually a book called Creeping Compromise, and basically what it said was, here are the things that are godly, and everything else is deception. Each little thing, and it played out in how we talk about entertainment and music, right? It played out in how we talk about how we engage with politics. It played out in all kinds of different realms of Christianity from what they took from this idea. But basically, the devil is trying to trick you. He's out to get you, and he's going to use any tool that he has to do it. And so what it created was a fear of exposure to new knowledge. There was a villainization of education that came from that. There was definitely a lot of prejudice because people held on so tightly and basically got this idea of, like, the more conservative and traditional something is, the more holy it is. That's what's safe. That's what's godly.
Because new ideas are the pathway for the devil.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't believe in present truth, right? Is,
that's the ironic thing.
Don't, Sean, stop
literally,
it.
Like, I am so drawn to the Adventist church because we believe you can learn more, right? Mm. Now, that's not culturally necessarily true. But as a church, as a movement, as a people, it is true. Mm-hmm. This is why we started. But what's crazy is... a movement that started from people laying it all out on the table and saying, like, let's go through this, let's explore it, turned into people idealizing, like, organ music and hymns that were written in a very specific time, right? Mm-hmm. Why? It's such an arbitrary choice of what's holy and what's not. It's not from Jesus' time.
True.
It's from, like, England. Like, in what so way?
England is the motherland, though.
But that's not Jesus' motherland, right? It's just
exactly.
It's just the fundamentalist kind of mentality that we went into in, like, the 1920s and 30s that wasn't even the original intent of our church. To hear that kind of thinking now is just sad but funny. But it was my reality growing up. It was the only thing I knew.
Yeah. Yeah. And for some of us, that's been our experience too, in many ways. We can definitely, on some levels, in many ways, I can resonate with what you're talking about. It's just amazing. Now my question, going back to kind of, when you started this, what year was it when it officially branded, like, you started Humans of Adventism?
I started doing interviews the beginning of 2017 and posted the first one summer of 2017. So I'm coming up on about 4 years of doing this.
So in that 4 year span, Caleb, would you say that your perspective on Adventism at large, its people as we make up this church, has it changed dramatically? Has it changed not at all? What's the biggest thing you've noticed since you started this project?
It's changed a lot. And what's crazy is the more that I explore the Adventist people, the more hope I have.
Wow.
Because both my criticisms of the church and the things that I liked about the church were all based on my reality. They were all based on what I'd been exposed to. So when I move to different places and I start complaining, like, man, Adventists are still stuck on wedding rings. They're still stuck on coffee, right? I would talk to somebody who was from, say, the Pacific Northwest, and they'd be like, no, they're not. Like, I've never in my life heard somebody who had a problem with those things. Right. And yet in my
we're all heretics out here.
In my experience, like, I had seen people ask to step down or not serve on in the church because of things like this. So as I've started exploring people, and then once you sit in a Russian Adventist congregation or a Samoan Adventist congregation, and you see kind of the ways that culture influences the things that we do, there are definitely similarities in most Adventist churches I've been to and most people, but there are so many different ways that we prioritize things. Health is a good example, right? For me, I had people literally coming to my academy to say, if you drink Mountain Dew, you are in danger of hell. Like,
wow, yeah.
It was that big a deal, right?
Anthony, you're done.
The amount of Mountain Dew that I drank in high school.
Oh, so did I while I was sitting listening to them say that. But then you get to somewhere where it's like, no, we care about health. Like health is what matters. And because we care about health, we're not going to overwork you. Right. Mm. Like, because we care about health, like, we actually want you to spend time with your family. So we're going to create maternity leave. We're going to create time off for you and your family. Right. A holistic view of health. It's not, are you going to hell because you ate pepperoni pizza? It's not by the letter, but yet we're united around the theory that health matters, but the way that it plays out as Adventists is totally different in some areas than others, for sure.
Yeah.
So kind of following up that, I'm happy to hear that you're more hopeful. That's really good. That's been something that I think all four of us, we've been kind of on that same track where we've been wanting to explore our church more. We've been having those conversations before the podcast where we wanted to know, why should we stay in this church? What is this church actually about? Who are we?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe less so as you've been taking the path of looking at the here and now, the humans that make up our church. And I love that approach. Yeah. What we've been kind of doing is looking back at what was our church built on? What were those principles and how do those still apply to today? If they do, is our church still relevant? Yeah. Does our church actually still have a message? And in some interesting ways, it sounds like listening to you that we've come to some similar conclusions with what our church stands for and what it doesn't when it comes to practice, when it comes to culture and actual belief, just in different ways that we came around to those things. But my next question that I'm curious about, Caleb, is when we look at today, we do have this interesting divide in our culture. And this is not just in the Adventist church, but I think it's seeped into our church culture as well, which is this. Our generation, we call it the millennials, and you can even say Gen Z.
Mm-hmm.
We love to hear these stories, right? Humans of New York, humans of Adventism. I'm sure that the majority of your demographic, maybe I'm assuming this, is probably our age group, age range. And maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe you have a huge wide range, but I know that a lot of 20 to 30 somethings love these stories. We love seeing these things on social media. But there's also at the same time, although we love to hear stories and like that authentic experience, you also have a rise in cancel culture. This idea that when we see someone disagree with us or we see on social media, especially that stands for a certain thing politically, could be religiously, our group is also tends to be the ones that are quickest to condemn and the quickest to judge. So there's this kind of weird.
And without any context story, which I think is key here, because obviously there's things people should be called to account for, but someone says a sentence and without any, so we love to hear people's stories on one side, the other side, it's like, I don't need to know your story.
You say one thing and that like in many ways it's permanently, as we're recording, there's stories right now that are going on that have to do with cancel culture.
The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
Just say it, Sean. It's the Mandalorian. I know that
this may be listened to, 50 years from now from people listening to our show. No, I know that's not going to happen 50 years from now, but
that's what I'm editing.
But anyways, Caleb, what are your thoughts on that? How do you feel about that kind of, do you consider it a double standard? Do you think it's necessary to have both where there's this desire to hear people's stories, get to know them? Like you mentioned before, you see the people with the weird clothes, but then we're like, oh, I can relate to them when I hear their story. Is that relatable in a way where if someone were to tweet something out or post something on Instagram, that should we have that same approach? Like, I need to know their story, or is it right for us to be ready to judge them and pounce on that?
in essence, Caleb, tell us how to solve cancel culture.
The world's biggest problem.
We need you to solve it all.
So I don't know that I really agree with your premise in the beginning. As far as like things that occupy my brain space, am I trying to solve cancel culture? No. Am I afraid of cancel culture? No. I think that this is a symptom of a larger issue, and that is covered abuse in every way. I mean, when you trace back to the reasons that people are so upset, the reasons they take this out on people, the reasons that they jump at things, you always find abuse. Whether that's the suppression of women, whether that's racism. I don't know that we are more likely to cancel people than any other generation. When you go back and you talk to my grandparents' generation, if someone did not wear a tie to church, that was a huge deal that people would gossip about and shame you for. Right? If you had a friend of another race, literally, I think it was 1960 before I would have been allowed to marry my wife. Right?
Wow.
So I don't know. This is, cancel culture irks me in some ways to even use that term, because it's taking the people who are trying to solve abuse and basically like villainizing them instead of going after the abuse itself. Right. And I'm not saying that this doesn't happen. I have met plenty of people who they need a cause. They don't want to listen to anybody else. They want to be the savior of everybody. It's fine. You know, it causes lots of problems, but I don't know that that's the majority of people. It may be louder online. You know, you may feel like, oh, I can't post anything without somebody jumping on me. Okay, but most of the people that I've talked to in person, and I talk to people all week, every week, you can find common ground. You can find a way to actually talk about these things, and you can find a way to hear their stories. But if you think about, you're a teacher, right? And you have one kid who's very obviously got more power than the other kid. Say he's stronger, taller, older, whatever. And you have him like hitting another kid. Do you feel equally bad for both kids if they get in a fight? No. You go after the stronger person. You go after the person who has more power because there's more damage that they can do, right? Mm-hmm. So when I look at cancel culture, like, there is not an, I don't want to hear the story of someone who beats his wife, right? Like, at the end of the day, the major problem here is that someone's wife is being beaten. There's a person being abused. So do I want both sides? Like, do I want to equally say, well, he was wrong for this, but she was also wrong for this? No, I want to go after abuse. And so that's kind of where I stand on that. I do think that this is a problem for internet people, internet natives, people who, and it's not just age, it's that we are used to operating online reactively instead of intentionally. And this has been a strong point that I've clung to since the beginning of kind of doing digital work with the church is, don't use the internet reactively. Don't go on there to find something to fight with, right? Like, use it. If, like, for example, there is a place to hold people accountable. And we need to use our voice for that. But you also need to empower people intentionally as well. Like, you can't just be anti things. You also have to build things. You also have to create resources. You also have to support people.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a hard question for me to answer because I don't necessarily see the world in the same way. But,
well, I think if I could just butt in real quick, I think part of it is just kind of because what you've said a few times is that listening to people's stories, you can talk, you know, with somebody and begin to understand where they're coming from. Like, for instance, I think that's one of the biggest things when it came to race, when things blew up back in March and or was it March, May? But it feels like it's been so long. It just feels like it's been a long time this year. But back when George Floyd was killed, you know, and everything blew up, as you start listening to stories, it's like you can't hear somebody's story and be like, well, that's just not true. Yeah. You know, you hear someone's story and it forces you into this place, like what you're saying is of opening up your worldview to something that's so much bigger. But what I find interesting is that we don't, and I agree with you on the abuse side. I mean, and a lot of what we might, a lot of what people say is cancel culture is just like we're just condemning the cancel culture when it's like, no, they're actually trying to solve something. But there is kind of that side of cancel culture, and which we don't like that term, but there's that side of it, which is just like, I don't care about your story. You just said the wrong
thing. Sure.
And that's kind of an interesting thing, the dichotomy between the two, between we really love people's stories. You just can't ever make a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, in public. And that's quite a hard dichotomy to, I don't quite understand how we, why we do
that. I struggle with this because I know that it took several years of intentionally trying to grow out of a very racist attitude, a very homophobic attitude, before I really started connecting well with people. And I know that it was people who should not have had to educate me that did. They should not have bore the weight of my education in any way. And yet I had many people in my life take me aside, take me alongside them, show me step by step, say, Caleb, I love you. Here's why what you just said really hurt me. Or here's why people might be angry at that. And to my credit, I listened, but I do know that it's been a long, long process. And I think there is something to what you're saying in that, like, it takes time and we want people to spend the time. Honestly, like, there's no satisfaction in bringing all of your anger and arguments and everything. And then somebody just like, you're right. I'm changed. Like, I didn't go through any emotional work. I just adopted your mind.
I think
the more privilege, societal privilege that you have, whether it's being a male, whether it's being American and having citizenship here, being white, whatever, I think the more privilege you have, the more responsibility you have to listen, because your story is being thrust on other people already. There is a way that male stories are intruding on women's lives when they don't ask them to be, in that they're occupying male run spaces often, right? It's the person in a position of power that really needs to take the time and listen. That doesn't mean that there's no value in anyone else listening. The only personal kind of way that I can relate this is age. So when I was starting, trying to work with churches and everything, trying to get back involved, I was living in a very like baby boomer occupied leadership area. It seemed like if I was ever on the board for something, if I was ever with anybody, I was like the one young person placed there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like the young adult there, so we can have a young adult there.
So what power do I have? Like, what am I bringing to the table against 12 baby boomers? Like, you know, at the same time, I did take the time to try to understand their mentality and their fears. And that helped my conversations quite a bit when I knew that they were afraid of like, well, everybody's looking at their phone and I don't use the internet. What are they doing on there? Like, are they just, you know, watching? Are they just wasting all their whole life away? You know, well, no, actually they're working, or they're organizing something, or they're like doing some highly productive things when they're looking at the phone on the elevator. Trying to navigate those fears and misconceptions was helpful to me. And yet I never want to communicate that the weight of that needs to go on the person who has less power. So that's the interesting line that I'm trying to navigate, is that every human being can benefit from listening to each other's stories. Every human being. But it becomes a God-ordained responsibility to people who have power to listen to those who have less. Conversion experience in my life, and something that I try to bring, especially to people of my own demographic, especially of people who have power that they don't see. Really, that's who I think can benefit the most, and maybe not them, but all of the people they interact with. How many interactions, how many toxic interactions, how many kind of abuse out of ignorance situations can we help avoid if we just give better communication skills, better listening skills to people who frequently abuse that power?
Mm-hmm. So good. Caleb, can we talk about empathy?
Yeah.
You seem to be in the empathy business maybe I'm wrong. No, I think that's my projection onto you, perhaps.
It's true.
Nice. So yeah, I'm curious your thoughts about empathy and empathy in religion.
Hmm.
Because humans of Adventism inherently includes Adventism, the religion of Seventh-day Adventism within it, you know, and there are certain parts of religion, right, that are, these things are true, these things are not, this is black, this is white, you know, there's certain things that we believe at the exclusion of other things, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that's sort of, not to make a positive or negative statement about that, but rather just like about religion in general, right? And so I guess my question is, how do you kind of carry empathy for others, valuing the stories of others, as well as not compromising on your own beliefs? How do we kind of carry both of those? Because I think to some people, when they hear you talk, they hear, oh man, if I value the stories of others too much, then I'm going to compromise. Then I'm going to, you know, if I talk to too many people, you know, in this community or that community, then I'm going to lose my sense of self. So I'm curious your thoughts on that.
I do think it depends when you go about religion. Where is your priority? Is it on keeping the letter of the law and trying to be pure in that way? Or is it in embodying the character of Christ? I think those are very different approaches to religion. I land on the side of, I'm really not sweating it. Like if I have a friend call me and they say, I am knocked out drunk in a nightclub and it is Friday night. Mm-hmm. I'm not the person who's there with them, but if they need a ride home, I'm not thinking like, oh, am I sinning by going in here and getting my friend and helping them? No,
right.
Like my love for them says, I am going to go be safety. I'm going to go be the person who's there for them, right? Mm-hmm. I'm really not sweating like, am I corrupting myself? Am I compromising my values of not going to clubs? My friend needs help and I'm going to get them, and that's what's happening here. End of story. Like, you know, I think this happens so often, and people are afraid because the purpose of their religion is either to avoid hell or to go to heaven. And so when you threaten, mm-hmm. either it gets them closer to hell or further from heaven, like that's mm-hmm. that feeling, that's that gut repulsion that you feel. That's really not why I am religious at all. That's not why I'm Adventist. It's not why I believe in Jesus. Like those things are great and I believe they're true. Mm-hmm. But the point is actually to bring Jesus into the world. Like it's to exemplify his mm-hmm. character. And so when I sit down and listen, you know, you could ask the same thing about Jesus sitting in a house full of tax collectors, prostitutes, sinners. Do you see that in Adventism? Hardly ever. Right? Mm-hmm. How many Adventist pastors are openly, vocally, like going into the community and the places that their church members wouldn't like, and ministering to people outside of their congregation? So you have Adventism versus Jesus in this case, and I choose Jesus.
Wow.
Now, Adventism, I will say, understood correctly, or my understanding of, and why I am Adventist is a holistic, beautiful picture of Jesus' character. To say that one day every single week we're going to rest is radical. It's revolutionary, especially in a capitalist society, to say like, no matter what, I'm not going to use this to make more money. I'm not going to, you know, avoid my family today. Like this is truly a day of renewal and worship. When you talk about health, now, if you talk about, you know, I'm gonna try to condemn you for eating a hamburger, that's not especially compelling to me. But when you talk about your health matters, like it actually benefits you and your relationships and your spirituality a lot. That's a beautiful picture of Jesus, not because it's condemning you if you don't, but because he has actually laid out ways to a better life, better relationships, and something that actually impacts you today on top of, you know, this kind of existential promise of heaven. There's real reasons to follow Jesus and try to live like him today.
Go for it, Anthony. Go for it.
Oh, no, I was just going to quickly comment on that. What you said was really poignant about the fear of heaven, or the hope of heaven, or the fear of hell. And when you feel like you're sliding too close to either, or, you know, it kind of creates that response within you, if you are a religious person. And I definitely have been in that space. And I know many, I think, who have inhabited that space where, and I think that's maybe where this question comes from, is so many people I know, friends, family, et cetera, and the Adventist community, I think do feel that fear. If I listen too closely, if I become friends with too many gay people, if I talk to a Muslim, you know, et cetera, is that compromising? Is that, you know, is that not being in the world, not of it, you know, something like that? And
let me follow up on that.
Articulated that well. Yeah.
Let me follow up on that. So, because I kind of lost track of your question in here, is it really faith if you're operating from not knowing anything else? Right. If your faith comes from intentionally knowing as little as possible, like, what kind of faith is that? No, I choose Jesus because Jesus is the truest thing in my life. Right. And it's from knowing other things. It's from exploring other things. It's from listening to other ideas and still choosing Jesus. That's faith.
That's
right.
Good.
So empathy. If you think about, this is a really easy exercise. If you think about someone who is Hindu and you think, what would draw me to their religion? Because it's not based on the Bible. It's not based on anything that I have context for. What would draw me to hearing more? Is it if they have a really good argument that, oh, here is the science behind lots of gods existing? No. Like, you automatically just reject that in your brain. There's nothing in you that says, maybe it is. But we do this with, like, let's explain to you dinosaurs. Okay, great. But that's not a way you start a friendship or a relationship. like the best ways, and the ways that I'm consistently talking about my faith, is by having a friendship with people and listening to them first. I live by three or four businesses right here on my street. I can see them right now. Okay. I know the people who work there, because consistently day after day, I go and support their business. I talk to them about their day. I ask about their stories. I sit down after they're off of work and talk to them for an hour and a half about their families. Okay. They know more about my church and faith and have a higher view of me as a religious person than I would ever have if I just took them a glow tract. Right. And I'm not here to villainize that in itself or in theory. Like,
what I hear you doing, Caleb, is exactly that. You're just saying, like, we should never give out anything. Anybody who does is a terrible, terrible
criminal. New headline for the episode. Caleb hates glow tracts.
That's another story.
No, but I see what you say. That's powerful.
Yeah. There's one more quick thing I'll share. There's a guy named Daryl Davis that basically led all of these people out of the KKK, right? I'm not here to tell anybody to do that at all. But what I am, I'm here to share some wisdom that he said. And basically, there's a line that he said where you are actively listening, you are passively teaching people about yourself. Because
I haven't heard that. I hadn't heard that. He's really good.
You're opening up a door where if they can get their story out first, if they can get their what's on their mind out first, people have a natural appreciation where they turn it back toward you. So once they have shared, once you have listened to them, they want to know more about you, because you may be the first person who sat down and listened to them in 20 years. I mean, I have interviewed people who are 70 years old who said, this is the first time anybody in my church has ever sat with me and just asked about my life.
To tag onto that last thing you're saying, Caleb, it's been really surprising to me. I don't know where I gained a love for hearing people's stories, but I just, I've always had it and enjoyed asking people, like, tell me about your life. Tell me. I think it comes from, because I love history. But anyways, it's kind of interesting. I've had a few people, you know, in my churches say that, oh, this is like the first time someone's asked me this or whatever. But it if I could share a little bit of dirt, it's been so interesting, because I think generations previous to our young adult generations, millennials, Gen Z, have generally been a little bit better at that. What's so interesting is I have had the hardest time getting young adults to even begin to ask that of especially older people than them. Just like, tell me about your life and actually have genuine interest. Mm. Because what's so interesting is I think our younger generations often feel so misunderstood, or just like all those boomers or whatever, you know, like, okay, boomer, like that whole thing. But we have hardly ever, at least in my circles, have hardly ever tried to understand their stories. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is then when you ask someone about their story, and then, as you said, there's that natural reciprocation that happens in the other direction. And now all of a sudden we begin to understand each other a little better. And so it's hard, because I agree with you that it's like, you know, I don't want to tell anybody go, you know, it's hard, like with the KKK. I'm not want to tell anybody go into this terribly racist organization, try and pull people out. But there is something to be said that ought we not become far better? And I'm not trying to say this as like a command, but I mean, it just seems like a really important thing that ought we not become far better at listening to people first, at being the ones who go to and ask, hey, tell me about your life. Like, what was it like for you when you grew up in the 60s? Or, you know, what's it been like for you living through this transition in technology? You know, it's got to be harder than me growing up in it and beginning to hear people's stories. I don't know. That just seems like an obvious thing, but it isn't. Yeah. And I'm not trying to lament that as much as just understand that better.
Caleb, I have a question.
I have your perspective on it.
Go for it.
Ooh, okay, Eric. Eric's our Emmy award-winning filmmaker, so I'm just warning you. What he's about to talk about is about all of. He's gonna dissect all of the shots, the cuts.
It's trash. I'm just joking. No, it's great. I love what you do. I'm kind of a practical guy, and I was just wondering if you could maybe give us and our listeners some pro tips on how to listen with real intention, I guess, because listening is a real skill and it's something you have to develop. And I think we could all be better at that. And you have so much practice with it. I wonder if there's any kind of ideas you have that are practical.
Lots of them. I mean, number one is intentionality. You know, go into it and say, like, I'm here because I want to know. I'm here because I want to learn. Like, that changes your posture immediately. You tend to hang on to the words that people are saying better. And going along with that is just like, ask about things you don't understand. When you talk to somebody of a different generation, they're going to reference things that happened when you were not born. They're going to talk about things that are very normal to them and their friend group and their peer group that are not normal to you. And so just say, hey, I actually don't know about that. Tell me more about that. Like use that as an opportunity. Anytime something comes up that you don't know, don't pretend you know. Just say, hey, like, tell me about it. What was it like to be drafted during Vietnam? You know, like, I have no context for a draft. What is that like? But I also think something people don't think about is asking better questions. So our go-to questions that we're kind of taught, and I hear this with new interviewers as well, and I always kind of laugh to myself, is like preference questions. What are your hobbies? What do you like doing? What is your favorite food? Like, these things do not bring you closer to anybody.
I'm so glad we didn't ask you any of those things at the beginning of the interview.
Yeah, we're all just sighing a huge relief.
But
I would have been.
But what is your favorite food, though?
Favorite hobby?
Oh, shoot. My favorite food?
We just got you sidetracked. Ignore us. Caleb, you've got it. You got to ignore us.
Yeah. You got me hungry now. So. Asking questions based around experience is a switch that has to happen, because those are things that grow you closer together. When someone tells you that something they have experienced, in your brain, you simulate what it's like to live through that. It's the same part of your brain that you use for memory. So you're actually simulating a memory in your own head, walking through it and saying, like, oh, with these factors that this person had, what would I do? Like, oh, I can't do the thing I normally would because I'm them now, you know? So there's something that happens when you hear stories. So some great questions. There's one question that I ask literally everybody, and that's, what is one event in your life that changed you? Now,
that's a good
all
question.
Five of us are going to have different stories that jump to mind. Number one, probably several stories that we go through different options. And then you're going to have options that are positive and negative, right? What are some things that impacted me in a positive way that changed my life in a positive direction and grew me into something I'm proud of? That's one direction your brain can go. But if you've ever been a victim of abuse, if you've ever gone through like trauma, which most of us have, those things change us too. A really easy point of connection now that literally the entire world has, what was it like when COVID-19 started? Like, what was the lockdown like? Yeah. What did you lose? What did you gain? Like, what were your fears those first few weeks? Every living person can connect because our world and the way that society works changed in a week, right? Mm. And we all have different answers. If you're a teacher, you had to learn an entirely new job. If you were planning on getting married in May of 2020, no one could come to your wedding. if you had an elderly relative that passed away, you probably had to do a Zoom funeral, right? Like there are so many ways that we were affected by just this one event. But in general, asking questions that center around someone's lived experience is really what's going to connect us. And not asking so you can judge or say, oh, I also have an experience just like that. Don't do that. Process what they say. Ask further questions. Say, tell me more about that. Because people, they'll test you. They'll throw out a really consolidated version of their story. Mm-hmm. Because most people don't want to hear more than 5 minutes of their story. But if you ask more questions, you can see the relief in people where they're like, well, actually, you know, it's funny. I got to explain more about that. And they'll take you further and further into the story.
Yeah.
Because there's a nervousness that happens like, they're asking this question that's so hard for me to nail down. And yet I got to tell them something. They probably don't want to hear it. I'm just going to rush through this. But when you go to that second, that third question, you actually assure somebody that you're interested. You actually show them in a visceral way that they matter to you and that you actually want to know. And that changes everything. I mean, I can't tell you how many friends that I have now that I can trace back to an interview because it started with someone willing to listen. I have people who were in college when I interviewed them, now are going off to grad school, now are starting these amazing new jobs, now are getting involved in their community in all these different ways. I have people who I interviewed that were in the church and 3 years later they've left, but I am their one remaining strong link to the Adventist church because I was the person who listened to them. And as somebody who does this, there's a whole, if my ministry is an iceberg, those stories are this little tip. All of the underwater stuff is the private messages. It's the people who are forming support groups around abuse. It's all of the Adventist kids who come out to me through a Twitter DM, right? Or an email that say, literally, it's not safe to tell my church. It's not safe to tell my family. It's not safe to tell my school. But somebody's got to know, and I want them to be Adventists because we have that shared link, and you're that person. I'm often a stranger to them.
Wow.
And yet I hear stories from people that their own family doesn't know sometimes.
That's incredible.
I think it's so important what you're saying, Caleb, because you are not only illustrating the how-to, but the effects that listening has upon a relationship on an individual that's being listened to, and as well as it has on the relationship afterwards. I have done my fair share of visiting as a lead pastor, you know, at a large church, about 130 people. And it's incredible the stories that you can learn and the relational equity that builds. And I hate to use that word because it kind of sounds like you're trying to use it, but really not that, but just kind of the stories that you would never, ever think. Like there's something to hit to the point that you were saying about visualizing someone else's story. There's a lady who she was like 5 years old, 6 years old when World War II ended, and the Russians stopped like 17 miles away from her town. And so she remembers how her mom and her sister, her mom took her and her sister up into the forest. They could see the town sort of, and the Americans came. They didn't know if they were the Russians or not. And so then the Americans come up to find them. And I get to this day, two, three years later, I still think about that story sometimes as if I was there. I didn't experience it, but I have so much more of a connection with this older German lady, you know, because she told me the story. Yeah. And it's so incredible it's the humanization of someone who, she won't listen to a podcast, so I feel safe saying this, but you know, she's a German, an older German woman. She has a very black and white look on the world, but now she's got 3D. She's got dimensions to her, in a way that if I just knew her from a few moments of talking or something like that, she would just kind of be maybe a harsher, older lady.
Yeah.
She's not. And that's the beauty of, I think, learning the stories. But what you were saying about coming in with intention and I'm here to listen, that's something that we don't do because we want the, what's the word? Immediate gratification. Yeah. of the depth of relationship or whatever it is quickly. But this actually leads me into talking about what you do in the documentary that's out. I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say this in what sound like extreme terms, but the documentary is not in and of itself exciting.
Yeah.
And by that, what I mean is you're not going through and, like, you know, there's not like a cut where there would be a commercial break and it leaves it on the edge of your, mm-hmm. the edge of your seat. And then it comes back in and you have the narrator being like,
"Find out so next there time."
And then, you know, exactly. It's not that it's literally two or three camera shots, of a person telling a story or answering some of your questions. And and there's no narration, there's no music. I can't recall if there's music, but it's not overly involved. There is. It's very simple. You're just listening. Tell us a little bit more about why you chose to do it that way.
My whole team struggled so much with this because I worked with people who make exciting videos. Like, this is their life. They're used to 2 seconds, half a second, cut. And you know, we're done in 10 minutes or less. And to work with me and my directional style, I over and over sent those drafts back and said, less music, slower shots, over and over. We're going to actually process what this person said. Don't cut that part out. Leave that in. Those are important details for the person listening. And we worked really well together, but it was a major adjustment to this style because that's not good internet in general. Good internet is really easy to watch while I'm multitasking, really emotionally charged. And you know, I can get in, get out and go on with my day, but that's not what I'm trying to do. Intentionally giving that feeling of, I am sitting down on the couch with this person, listening to their story. If I can't do that, I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
I'll help other people. But if Humans of Adventism is going to do something, we aren't going for exciting. We're going for deep, meaningful, right? We're going for relational. Yeah. We're going for something that you're going to watch again and say, like, man, I zoned out there for a second. I really want to hear what this person had to say. And it's an adjustment for us. It's an adjustment for me. I sat down and watched the trailer through the last episode all in one go. And I committed, I'm not going to look at my phone while I do this. I'm not going to like have other conversations going on. I'm not going to multitask. I'm actually going to sit here and process this. And there's just something different that happens when you do that. And the goal that we wanted to accomplish was not to be entertaining. It was to actually be challenging. It was to actually leave somebody with like something that sticks in their brain, like still thinking about it. What is that thing that's itching my brain? And I hope that is something that becomes something that plays out in their life. You know, like, oh man, what is my purpose? Like, I got to ask some people about how they found their job or how they found their ministry or something like that. So it was very intentional to the point where like we put in many more hours making it that instead of just going to what is kind of naturally watched online. This is something that I imagine people with their families sitting down and watching on their television at the highest quality, one episode at a time. Not something that you watch on your phone while you're on the bus. You know,
Yeah, because when I heard you were coming out with a documentary, it was interesting because when it came out, it was, you know, 1 out of 10, 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10. And now it's a lot easier to see why you made that choice, because it's not meant to be consumed, you know, as a, okay, cool, like I did that.
Yeah.
It's meant to be consumed as a, I listened to that well.
If two or three people come out of this with a different perspective and it alters their relationships in a positive, more Christ-like way, we have fulfilled our goal. And even if it doesn't get like thousands and thousands of views, it's doing pretty well anyway, which is great. But the point is not as many views as possible. It's as many intentionally, explicitly changed approaches to the world as possible.
That's a completely different mentality.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a paradigm shift.
And I'm not trying to demolish other people in this, but that is a very different mentality than we usually have.
Yep.
Wow.
Well, Caleb, I want to ask you this. You've given us some practical advice about things that we could say, or not things we could say, questions we could ask, intentions, like the way we could come to conversations with other people. And I, for one, am incredibly impressed with your heart for people, but also the way that you live that out and the way that you listen. I already see that you would be one of those guys that I would be like, let's just talk. And Caleb would listen so well. So like, I just want to say that, but, one more question before we end. And I know you got some stuff that you're doing with Humans of Adventism that, people could take part in or, enjoy. But what do you think is, if there's a practical action that someone takes away from this, you know, like, hey, I listened to this interview. This is great. I love what Caleb does. I love his heart, his mentality, all of that. You know, what's a simple thing that someone could do to start some of this?
Yeah, I think step one, find one person every week, one single person every week that you can just get to know a little better. And I know, you know, it can be different with COVID, but I don't think that has to stop anybody. One of the intentional things that I do is just text somebody. I'm just like, hey, I was just sitting here, you know, I'm off of work, and I was just thinking about this time, this memory that we had together that one time 3 years ago, and I was wondering how you're doing. Right? Well, they'll say, I'm pretty good, man. How about you? Like, they're not going to get into their story right away. It's like, well, I'm doing pretty good. It just snowed here for the first time in Portland. Like, how are you right now, though? Like, you know, really express your like interest in getting to know them. If you're not good at texting, like find a coworker, find like even with each other, you guys, like there are, you know, less about each other than there is to know, if that makes sense. You guys, for all the stories that you know about each other, there are 100 more that you don't know, even if you grew up together. And just taking that time and saying like, man, we just got off this interesting call. Like, what is something that changed you? Like, what is something that impacted you? What is something that you're afraid of? And how did that form? You know, what was a moment that gave you hope one time? You're going to find out and build like a different type of relationship, a deeper friendship than you would have thought to. So step one is just find one specific area every week to put this into practice. I don't care if it's your grandma. I don't care if it's your brother, your wife, you know, like whoever. It might be that person at the coffee shop, but like starting with the interest, starting with the intentionality, starting with the hope of that conversation is step one, because most people don't know to think like this.
Caleb, that's such a good sermon right there. There's such a good sermon in there. I'm not even a pastor. I'm
this whole thing is better sermon.
No, I think this speaks so well to our church, like wrapping it into just our mission, like what we should be doing as a church. You know, we spend thousands, if not millions of dollars on figuring out how to evangelize. And what you're presenting is what we need to do moving forward on all levels. And it's difficult, right? You know, especially when you're not used to it, you've gotten into that rhythm, but I'm sure when you first started, there's times where it felt awkward. It maybe even felt forced, but even in a forced conversation, at least you're having a conversation and you learn how to make it more organic. And it is really challenging. I think you definitely are speaking truth to each one of us to try to strive for that even more. And even in our lines of work where we do interact with people, you're absolutely right. We can do more. We can learn more from the people we know. And sometimes those are the people we talk to the least because we just find ourselves in those rhythms.
Mm. You know, so I now am at a point where I have the church's ear, the organizational church's ear. I'm actually on boards to things, talked with Hope Channel, like all of these different outlets and things. And one of the questions I get consistently is like, the world is becoming so secular. How can we possibly, you know, evangelize or like, you know, make people want to be part of this? And, you know, we relied on a crutch for so long, and that was a shared understanding of the Bible as truth. We're like, okay, you already believe in the Bible, just change these specific beliefs and come into our church. But the church has not had to face someone who doesn't believe the Bible is true.
Like,
you know, and that's the realm I occupy. That's where I live. And they think it's so much harder because they're coming at it with this heady intellectual, I'm going to convince you of the facts kind of approach. No, you're not. You're not going to convince anybody that way. Maybe people who are already inclined that way. That's why we get a lot of conspiracy theorists, right? But to the majority of
careful, Caleb.
I'm vocal about this.
I think we all agree with you.
The majority of people want to see, like, okay, but does this make you a better person? Yeah. Like, are you kinder than the person who's an atheist that I just talked to? And generally, no, you're not. So they're like, why? If you think about it from their perspective, why would they want a God that makes you that way? Why would they want to be less kind? Why would they want to be less involved in their community? Why would they want to be a more judgmental person? No, we don't want that. So when you take the time and you actually get to know people, this is the way to approach a secular world. Because just having that attitude and character of listening and being present and being supportive of them is revolutionary. A lot of people aren't finding this in their atheist friends. A lot of people aren't finding this in whatever other group that they're with. They're finding other theories and things, but when you show them Christ's character, that is compelling. And they may not ever take the label of Christian. They may not ever buy into Christianity because of the harm that we've done. Okay? But they are being exposed to Jesus through you. And that's my number one goal. Is how can I show Jesus' character in this moment, in this life, to this person? And I think even though it's not a direct one-to-one conversion, like we would kind of numbers-based hope, I do think that the end result is a greater likelihood that people will come to Jesus.
Mm. Caleb, it seems like we're wrapping up here and we want to honor your time. Maybe I have one more question for you, and it relates back to something you said really early on. And you had mentioned the time when you had walked away from church, but then you had also returned. And I was curious about that, maybe just to practice asking questions in my own life to you now. I'm curious what brought you back. I think all of us, we have friends, I know I certainly do, who have walked away, who have left, maybe even been in places ourselves where I've been in moments where I've questioned and wondered, man, should I just walk away? And so I'm wondering, what brought you back?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it short. I left the church because I felt like it was a stumbling block. I felt like the church was actually getting in the way of my relationship with God. Because what was church to me? It was coming on Saturday, was listening to a sermon and children's story. It was playing handbells with the handbell choir. Great. Classic. How was I being the hands and feet of Jesus? You know, like I could use that Sabbath to actually go help somebody. I could actually get the rest that I need. You know, I was working a full-time job and going to school, desperately broke, driving a car that was breaking down all the time. And nobody even knew because we didn't have that sense of friendship and community. You know, I left the church, I think, the last straw was the pastor invited me to pizza. Like, yes, great. We're broke. We're hungry. Let's go. Never solidified a time. I texted him. He didn't text back. Next time, exact same invitation. We should go to pizza sometime. Yes, we would love that. When? Never came through. It happened three times. Exact same words, exact same invitation, no follow-up. And just the combination of that, being handed a list that said, like, you've been in this church this much time, you need to sign up for responsibilities. When I had carved out the time to just be there, you know, like, I didn't have anything else to give, unfortunately. And they didn't know me well enough before they shoved that list in my face. And I was like, look, this is not Jesus. This is not drawing me closer to God in any way. It just makes me angry. I'm done. I don't need this. Like, I have a relationship with God, and I was still Adventist. I still celebrated Sabbath every week. I still, like, believed in generally Adventist principles. And yet I saw no use for my local church experience.
Yeah.
And it was exactly finding that brought me back. So there was this little church, 12 senior citizens. My parents had moved up to this little town out in the country in South Carolina and started going there. And basically the church just said, hey, we need help. We have opinions about things, but it's been, you know, multiple years since a baptism. We have no young people left. We have barely any older people left. First time I went in there, they were watching a Doug Batchelor sermon on the TV screen because they had a shared pastor and no one to preach. Right. They had a children's story anyway, but there were no kids. Just this weird experience of a shell of programming that didn't do anything. Wow. I felt for spiritual experience. And so they started Saturday afternoons. They started going through this series that basically self-educated them on different generations, what we'd lived through, how we communicated, what was important to us. And week after week, they would have these, and they invited me to one, and they said, hey, you don't have to attend our church. Like, we just want your feedback. We just want to know, like, we don't have any way to access the opinions of younger people. We aren't online, really. Like, just come and give your feedback. Tell us some things that are important to you because we want to grow. Church members started saying, hey, if you need some work Sunday, you can come and help me move boxes or garden at my house or whatever random jobs they had. When they went to pay me, they paid me more than I asked. So there were these relationships built and this real strong sense of community. And then we started going and helping people who weren't part of the church move or mow their yard or pay their light bill. You know, like, I found those things that were missing. And I think in order to bring anybody back or get anybody involved again, they're going to have to see real impact on the community. They're going to have to see people's lives actually being helped. You're not going to do it with programming. Even if you're super cool, you just aren't.
Really quick, I know we're going long, but this is a really fast question for you, Caleb. So when it comes to actually connecting, because this is all about connecting and getting to know people, within this COVID climate, we have hope this year, right, with the vaccine and everything. But a lot of times as the church, we play this waiting game for witnessing and building relationships. You know, the old word is friendship evangelism. And look, I love I love the heart behind it, because really what you're doing is that, is getting to know people, right? And if it leads to that conversation, great, right? I'm not going in with the hidden intent, like, I need to, like, slip this in somewhere, you know, like, I can have that in the back of my head that I desire that for them, but I'm still just building a relationship, right? But in this climate of COVID, do we have to wait till this is over before our church can get to know new people, or do we just play this waiting game?
It's going to mean more if you do something now, because it's hard, because people are isolated. You reaching out to them and actually genuinely wanting to know how they're doing. I mean, even if you've got $50 to spare, if you've got any kind of a little service budget, and just saying, hey, do you need any groceries? Like, we can bring some things by for breakfast this week, or I can connect you with a food bank, or I can connect you with a job, right? Like, any of these little just signs that you're interested and you care and you want to be involved and you're available, now is the perfect time to do that. I would say last March was the perfect time to do that, right? April was the perfect time to do that. But if you haven't done it yet, today is the perfect time to do that. because, like, people need people. Like, we can't get away from it. As much as we move online, as much as we move out of kind of maybe a centralized church experience, there is never going to be a time where we get away from our need for interaction with other people and support from them. And so, you know, today you just got to get creative in how you do it, but it's so possible, you know, and it's, I would say it's almost easy. I am naturally an introverted person. I was very uncomfortable with my first 200 interviews. But over time I've seen just how little people need to be seen and heard. And it's just intentionality. It really is. Even if you blunder, even if you don't have the best words, even if you are afraid of cancel culture, right? there are steps you can take to let somebody know they're seen, they're appreciated, and they're loved, and you genuinely want to know them.
So good.
Caleb, I want to say, Ian, thank you so much for coming on here. Now, there's obviously the Facebook page, and do you have the Instagram as well? I haven't checked on that, but do you have the social media pages where you can go on, you can like those, subscribe, so that you can follow the stories that you post? But there's also a couple more things that that you have going on. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. I work with two teams. One was kind of our documentary team for Humans of Adventism. If you want to check out everything Humans of Adventism, go to humansofadventism.com. There's even conversation starting cards that we sell on there. You can watch the whole series, get an understanding of who we are and how we interact with the church. But I also work with another team through the Adventist Learning Community that's producing a podcast called How the Church Works. And so basically we've gone through, we've called, you know, the NAD president, XGC presidents, Oakwood University former president, like people who have a structural knowledge of how this church works, because how I thought the church worked and how it does work are very different. You have more voice and more agency as an individual than I ever knew before I started working on this. We don't have to start church at 11 o'clock. We don't have to use a Sabbath school study guide. There are a lot of resources made for Adventism that we just kind of do because it's provided that are not required. Even just the simple knowledge that it's my local church who gets to choose whether they disfellowship me or not is a completely new idea to me that I was never taught, you know, growing up. So if anybody wants an understanding of kind of the mechanics of how it works, the history behind it, why we have state and regional conferences, for example, and the story behind that. Just kind of an all-in-one package of what is the organization that calls itself Seventh-day Adventists. I really encourage people to check that out because so many of us feel hopeless. And that's based on the exposure we have. It's based on our local realities. And those are not everything there is. They're not even close. The Adventist Church is so much bigger than we think and is involved in so many other areas than just our local church service. And there are ways to get involved no matter whether you kind of agree with what's going on locally or not. So I'm really excited about that. And really anything the Adventist Learning Community produces, I would just say check them out. They produce the Advent Next podcast, which is a fantastic theological exploration of our beliefs and how those grow and will grow over time. But I guess in short, I would just say there are so many creative, amazing projects coming, and I would say even culture shifting things happening right now, that this is an incredible time to be part of this.
That's awesome, man.
So awesome.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I can, just from a practical standpoint, just wanted to say that those conversation cards are probably an extension of some of the questions that you suggested you could ask to start a conversation. So if you wanted to do things practically, that's a great way to, especially because I've actually struggled with this myself as a pastor. I'm like, I want to ask better questions. I mean, that's a great way to do that. But across the board, Caleb, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate you. We appreciate what you're doing within Adventism here, as you help to create a culture and teach us how to better listen and love those love people through listening, maybe is the best way to say it, those around us. So yeah, thank you, Caleb.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Seeking What They Sought. Special thanks again to Caleb for taking the time to visit with us. Caleb, thanks, man. All right, we'll catch you guys in the next episode of Seeking What They Sought.